Good morning and you're very welcome to the show. Obviously, you can guess what the front pages are all about today. So the Mail has a poll on it. Country split over move to level 5 poll. This was taken yesterday between 11 o'clock and 3 p.m. So fast turnaround, a randomised SMS poll of 1,000 people. So 51% of people think yes, go to level 5. 41% of people say no, and 9% of people say they don't know. The Mail also has lots of quotes from what they're calling the hawks and doves in the cabinet and in government. One quote there, a guy says of Neffet, or a guy or a girl says of Neffet, F off, we have to run the country. The Sunday Times, cabinet posed to up lockdown level for nation. So we saw Eamon Ryan coming out of that of those meetings yesterday, and he was saying, look, we're not rushing into anything here. There's a lot of analysis to be done. So the Sunday Times saying here that analysis is like an assessment of the cost to each sector of the economy, and Stephen Donnelly doing an assessment of the impact on non-COVID care. So it looks as if they are actually doing this quite scientifically, I guess. It does say in there, give people heart, the government is determined to keep schools open. And you will see they are very much pumping out information about how safe the schools are all the time. Sunday Independent, 260 million a week bill as the lockdown intensifies. So that's how much it'll be costing in PUP and supports to businesses and so on. So the Sunday Independent saying a mix of level 4 and level 5 restrictions this week. One of the other pieces of work that apparently is being done is a more up-to-date definition of what are essential services. So that's if we do go to some kind of level 5. Ciara Kelly inside saying that hairdressing should be an essential service, and I think some people would agree with that. They also have a sidebar here in the Sunday Independent, and look, this is bubbling around all the time. You might have heard Dr. Andy, who's a public health doctor, yesterday, and Katie Hannon. She mentioned specifically like celebrations after sporting events. We keep hearing it. Maeve Sheehan has a piece here saying post-match celebrations have emerged as one of the most common sources of escalating outbreaks around the country. The Business Post, extra beds in doubt as private hospitals oppose new HSE deal. So some of the private hospitals are saying, well, maybe no, we're not going to do a deal. They're not happy with the cost, apparently, some of them. And also there are concerns, and you can see why, about the 5-day notice period proposed by the HSE. So it looks as if the HSE proposed to go to them and say, in 5 days, we need X services, X beds from you. So you can imagine that could make it quite difficult to run private hospitals under those circumstances. Also, sidebar there, fears mount for Aer Lingus routes in Cork and Shannon. So Ryanair already pulled out of there. I mean, that is just, it's disastrous for Cork and Shannon Airport, all of this. Like, you wonder, will that be, if everyone else gets over this in reasonably good shape, like the long-term damage there to aviation and to Cork and Shannon connectivity and to those communities. The Sunday World, exhume my murdered little girl, that's House of Horror victim Cynthia Owens. And Off Their Heads is the front of the Mirror. Off-license trading was in doubt last night. And I think that's largely coming from Robert Troy, who has been banging that drum for the last week or two. And The Sun on Sunday has what for a lot of you I know was the story of the week, Dominic West. And they have a story here, Snake on a Plane, saying that married Dominic West stunned fellow passengers by passionately kissing Lily James on a flight to Rome. It looked like they were heading off on a dirty weekend, said one onlooker. And all the rest of us can think is, oh, the thought of getting on a plane to Rome, and oh, the thought of having a dirty weekend. But there you go. Now, our panel this morning, Gabrielle Colleran is Vice President of the IHCA and Consultant Paediatric Radiologist at the National Maternity Hospital. Stephanie Preisner is a writer and actor. And Dan O'Brien is Chief Economist at the Institute of International and European Affairs. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So look, it does seem as if we are potentially going into some form of some kind of a lockdown. So maybe if we just take a sounding on that from around the table so everyone knows where everyone's coming from. Dan O'Brien, do we need to up restrictions? Do we need to go into a lockdown? Do we need level 5?
Well, can I just make an observation, Brendan? Foreign diplomats based here have been asking me, why is the conversation so catastrophic in this country? And Irish friends abroad ask the same thing. And I don't have a good answer for it. Why are we focusing on the negatives, restrictions all the time rather
because
than...
Because it's a catastrophe?
Well, it's a very serious thing, I agree. But I do, you know, when we start doing things differently from everyone else, though we're facing the same problem, then I begin to sort of ask questions as to why are we so, why do we treat this so differently from other countries? Of course, it's absolutely serious. And there are some worrying developments at the moment. But I do think we need all to calm down. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of things are happening in terms of treatment, in terms of vaccine. And as Ciara Kelly points out today in her piece, Dr. Ciara Kelly, the fatalities in Ireland are a fraction of what they were when this thing struck. And that is the same all over Europe. And the way they're changing. You know, we had a tsunami in the spring. And that was what was so horrifying about it. The rate at which hospitalizations, within a couple of weeks, we had nearly 1,000 people in hospital with COVID. The second wave, this has been more like a gradual wave. There now, currently, the numbers have been going up. It is worrying. But there were more than three times more people in hospital in the Republic at the height of the first wave than there are right now, according to the figures.
So right
there were
now
more than five times
the
more
most
people.
Extreme position
and,
we've been in,
and it's
we're going
changing
there,
more
told.
Gradually. Yes, it is changing more gradually. But I, you know, I do think that the whole national conversation, you know, one foreign diplomat said to me, you know, why are you traumatizing yourselves? This is a serious situation. But let's not traumatize ourselves. And let's also focus on things that are happening, that are making things better, as happens in other countries. Like watch American news and you'll find, you know, a mix of stories about advances with the vaccines, a mix of things.
Yeah,
but here we just seem to
we're
constantly
we're
focus.
We're covering those stories too.
Not as much as in other countries, and we're giving more prominence to the everyday. The numbers are out, and it's, you know, it's also everything is an absolute. This is serious, but it's not bubonic plague, and it is not even Spanish flu. Like, let's just think about the Spanish flu. You know, 150 million people died in the Spanish flu over 2 years. Now, the population of the world at that time was just one third what it was. In today's terms, that would be 150 million people. Now, how many people have died from COVID so far in 9 months? More than 1 million, which is, of course, a tragedy. But our great-grandparents got through the Spanish flu. It was hugely difficult. Many more people, 20, 30,000 people died of the Spanish flu with a much smaller population. So I'm just saying, I think we just need to dial down the catastrophizing and have a little calm and deal with this with fortitude. It is difficult.
Okay, so just on that. So, Gabrielle, coming from a medical point of view, what do you think of what Dan has just said?
So I'd agree with some and then there's other things that I'd have a different perspective on. But just to take it back a second, I think one of the challenges, and Dan has kind of articulated, is that there can be a prominence given to people who want to say dramatic things on the airwaves. And we've seen that in recent weeks and in recent months. And I've had situations personally where I've been asked to go on shows, and when reviewers have talked to me and I've been saying measured and balanced things, you know, I sort of get the Tinder swipe left of, well, we're going in a different direction with that segment. And then they'll have somebody else on who'll be very dramatic and very controversial. And so what I would say is that when we... NPHET are the people who have the access to all the data. And some of the criticisms of NPHET have been very unfair around things like they're not taking mental health or they're not taking the economy into account. The public health specialists who sit on NPHET, they are the medics with the most training at taking in the social determinants of health into account, mental health, the whole picture. So nobody wants to be recommending additional restrictions. But what people want to avoid is excess deaths from COVID-19. Like, the honest answer is, this is very hard. These decisions are difficult. And I actually, and I say this as a consultant and as the Vice President of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association, I get frustrated when I hear some of my colleagues, mainly male to be honest, coming out and making these really strong statements about what we should definitely be doing. If this was easy, we'd already be all on the same page. It's not. And we'll only know in 2, 3, 4 years' time how many of the decisions that we made were correct. Because it's when we take the whole thing into account, you know, do we have excess cancer deaths from, say, colon cancer in 3 years' time because of delays in diagnosis related to a lack of capacity for non-COVID care? All those things will be taken into account when we look back. But at the moment, all we can do is make the best decisions with the information we have. But the key thing is, as that information changes, as we learn more about the disease, as we learn more about the impact, as the treatments change, we have to be quick and agile to change. And one of the things I think that we could all work on is being a little bit more understanding of the fact that people are making decisions with incomplete information that changes. Like,
but
I'm someone who
can be... the stakes are so high.
The stakes
like,
are so
if we're
high.
Wrong here...
But we will be wrong some of the time. The,
yeah, but... So, like, I suppose it depends how wrong we are.
So, like,
but
as...
There is... We have potentially destroyed our economy and our society... as Dan says, in a fit of catastrophizing, if we are wrong here, have we?
So, like, Anthony Staines is very good on this in terms of the damage to the economy coming predominantly from the impact of the disease itself, COVID-19. I think what we've seen so far are people making the best decisions with the information available. And where I would agree with Dan is that our strong focus has to be, and at the moment, there's never been a better time for borrowing. And Dan, you can correct me if I'm wrong. What we should be doing is correcting the deficits in our system, the ICU capacity deficits, the acute hospital deficits, so that
okay,
we can
we'll
cope
come
with
to,
all
we'll come
the
to
care
all
and then okay. have less economic impact. Because
can I ask
the
you the simple question of do we need to go to some form of a level 5 now, in your opinion?
So I think NPHET are the best people to give the advice on the most appropriate public health decisions to the government. But where I might differ from other people is that I don't have an issue with Cabinet making a different decision, because it's their role to govern. They're the elected officials. They take that into account with the geopolitical considerations, which include the fact that we have the 6 counties and the border issue, and that we don't have an all-Ireland approach at the moment, which has a massive impact. Anything we do that the North does different dilutes our response.
Okay.
So I think NPHET are making the best decision they have, having all the information. I'm basing my opinions and my interpretations based on what we have, which is in the newspapers. They have all that additional information. But Micheál Martin and the Taoiseach and the rest of the Cabinet, they have to then govern, and they have the choice whether to take that advice or how much of that advice to take. And ultimately, we'll only know in the long run which approaches were right, and we won't get it right all of the time. But what we can do is act in good faith. I do think the government need to be better on communication around transparency about what's making the decision, because I think some of the thing that is traumatising for people
yeah.
is hearing the recommendation and then not hearing the logic behind why other decisions were made. And the concern that ordinary people has is, well, is that the lobbying groups? Is it people influencing
yeah,
government
I
decisions?
Yeah, I think in fairness, they did explain the logic fairly comprehensively of why they didn't go to level 5 the last time. Stephanie Preisner, are you traumatised? Do you feel we're catastrophising the conversation around this?
So, yes, I am traumatised. And two, I don't... It depends on who we are. If we are the media, then maybe we are catastrophising it. I do think there's an awful lot of really grim information. And in fairness, you know, a lot of the media is taken up by lobbying groups who are trying to save their businesses, and that's understandable. But from... like a human perspective, like my normal friends who aren't in the media, who are just there's a great sense out there of people being like, we just yes, it's they're scared of the catastrophe that might be at hand, but they do want some sort of rule of law to come in, because what's happening now is creating chaos. And I know it was much easier.
You mean in society in general, the people not keeping restrictions, some people keeping
yeah.
restrictions?
And like, yeah. I personally don't believe that anyone who's not keeping level 3 restrictions is going to keep level 5 restrictions. And I think that there needs to be more support for the guards. I think there needs to be fines. There has to be some way of enforcing this. Like, even last night, within... I don't know how many metres, like 100 metres, 200 metres of my house, I could see at least 3 households breaking the rules. And I'm absolutely powerless to stop it. I can ring the guards, I can ring everyone I want till the cows come home, I can tweet about it, but no one, there's nothing that at the moment that can be done, because I see people being like, ah, sure, the guards can't do anything anyway. If they stop you at a checkpoint, you can just drive on, they've nothing to do.
Yeah, but the guards don't want the powers either. They say, the commissioner says they don't need more powers. And
but sure, what's the point then? Like,
look, somebody told me
for,
they were in town yesterday. Right.
It was
and they
bedlam.
Were you there?
I wasn't there. I
they
drove
were horrified
through town.
By
I've
it.
Seen videos as well of last night, but I drove through town yesterday in the afternoon, and it could have been the afternoon of this time last year. And I don't know if it's because people are panicking, because they're like, this is the last time we can get out, because Monday's going to be locked down, have to get all the Christmas presents, have to do everything. But it was just bananas.
Oh yeah, but this person went around and counted how many people were outside pubs and stuff as
oh,
well.
Way
there
more
were 40
than 15.
People outside one pub.
It's
you know,
they
actually
shocking.
Physically counted them. They said there were plenty guards around, but they weren't doing anything about it.
Yeah, and I tweeted a similar video a few weeks back, and I deleted it in the end because, well, for another reason, but also the amount of people jumping on me. Like, there was 40 people at least sitting outside a restaurant. Well, not 40 people, but there were 19 people sitting outside a restaurant in South William Street, up on top of each other. And then I'm getting the blame for driving down South William Street, which I'm allowed to do, but I'm the cause of it because they can't pedestrianise South William Street. And it's... who is it down to? Like, people are, it's fair enough people want to meet their friends, they want to go for lunch. But it has to be down then to the restaurant to be like, look, we are going to enforce rules that keep you safe. But they don't seem to be doing it because obviously they're trying to make the most money that they can, which is understandable because they're on their knees. But so somewhere someone needs to come in and be like, look, we will be the parent here. We are going to put in the rules, because everyone trying to regulate themselves is just causing normal civilians to fight and bicker amongst themselves.
Dan, has there been some failure on some level here that we are now looking at moving to level 4 or 5 and potentially shutting down the economy in a much more terminal way for a lot of businesses now, when level 3 should have been enough if we had managed to get people to keep to it?
Well, look, as Gabrielle says, we are not going to know, okay? The uncertainty is everywhere here. It's like being in a minefield. We can't stay where we are. We have to move. But no matter which way we go, the risk is we stand in a mine. Now, whether that's a health mine, or whether that's a jobs mine, or whether that's a closing businesses mine. But we have big risks, and we have to live with those risks, and we have to live with the uncertainty of not knowing what we have to do. But let me just make a point.
So in terms of all those people being out and those people in South William Street that Stephanie's talking about and everything, is that people who, do you think, okay, fair enough, they're taking a risk assessment themselves and out they go?
Well, that's going to happen. You know, clearly, all the medical advice is don't cluster together in groups because that's going to spread it more. So it's not a good idea. On the other hand, I am not going to criticise kids with hot blood who are starting life and trying to live their lives. I'm not going to go into that. What I would say about measures is that a group of Oxford academics put together try to measure how stringent restrictions are. Okay, across Europe, Ireland is now already the most stringent. Okay, we have more restrictions than any other country, according to this measure from these Oxford academics. Now, again, my question with any kind of policy is, who's doing things differently? Why are they doing things differently? Are there outliers? Are there extreme cases? Why? So I would ask, why are we more stringent than Spain and France, which have far more cases?
Because our health system is worse than Spain and France.
I don't buy that whole argument.
What do you mean you don't buy it? It's a fact.
It's not a fact.
And okay? I'm not the expert, but Gabriel, you can say.
Look, if you look at the OECD that looks at comparative health systems, we put more money into our health system than most other countries.
Yes,
and
I'm not
we're
saying
mid-ranking,
it's efficient, though.
Mid to upper in terms of our outcomes, in terms of cancer survivor. If you look across a whole range of metrics, there is this thing, and some people in the medical profession have a reason to want to keep saying that we must put more money into the health system. But overall, our health system performs broadly in the mid-range, slightly upper range compared to the rest of Europe. So this notion that we have a third world health system is simply not true.
So Dan, I don't know where you're getting Gabrielle. Can I come in on that? So yeah. I don't know where you're getting the third world health system from, and I think the phrase itself is actually really offensive to third world countries and should be avoided. But if you take the example of Germany, they have 29 ICU beds per 100,000. We have 6.1, so we're right at the lower end. And that does impact. And if you look at the lockdown that we had in March and in April, it was very closely titrated to what our hospitals could cope with. And the reality is that if our ICUs are filled with patients with COVID-19 who need to be ventilated, then, you know, your aunt, my cousin, your friend who has colon cancer and needs to have an ICU bed to have their surgery, or our family members with sepsis, we end up in really tricky situations where we aren't able then to provide care for those people. So the answer in that is to provide the capacity. And so, Dan, we're talking about OECD averages on spend, but when you're talking about our spend, you're actually including the private out-of-pocket, which comes from people like us who are paying for private health insurance on top of it. So the state doesn't really get to take credit for the fact that access to scheduled care is so limited that means so many people feel they have to have private insurance in order to get access to care. So if we come back to what we have half the average EU number of beds, we have half the EU number of consultant specialists, and we're right at the bottom of the table for ICU capacity. Those things massively influence the decisions that NPHET make in terms of recommendations, because none of us want to see situations like we saw in Lombardy, where there are people not being ventilated or having to make decisions based on age and ventilating a 50-year-old ahead of a 60-year-old. But equally, all of us who are in the medical profession, we want every patient to get access when they need it. So anybody who has cancer, heart disease, who needs an ICU bed, we want them to have it. But the answer, as Dan has articulated before, and which I agree with, is not in catastrophizing, it's actually saying, right, we're putting that capacity in and then we can actually cope with more. And that's what we're calling for.
Why didn't we build... I'm going to ask you a really stupid question now. Why didn't we build a hospital really fast spend £1 billion or whatever we needed to spend, a massive COVID hospital full of ICU beds, try and staff it up as best we could and keep it out of the health system. Why is 140? I still can't understand why 140 patients are in danger of paralysing the whole health system now. Why is the COVID in every single hospital, every single A&E, contaminating everywhere?
So there's a few aspects to that. So one is we don't necessarily know that a patient has COVID when they come in, because anybody with respiratory symptoms now could have it.
But as soon as they do, whip them out of there and get them into it.
So people can come in who are having scheduled care, having an operation, and then it turns out when they're checked first that they have it and they haven't had symptoms yet, okay, or they're asymptomatic. So there are challenges, and even though we do a huge amount into that, but the idea of a single COVID hospital, there's some merit, there's some challenges, but actually there's a lot of merit in putting in a huge hospital with additional capacity where the scheduled care could place and patients who have cocooned for their surgery can go in and still have their elective surgery, because that
so
takes
a COVID
pressure
free
on the
hospital.
But
as
would
much
we
as
have
for
like the nurses care. For
and
that.
Again, so you see, it does come back to staffing, because a bed isn't a bed until you've got the staff to run
okay.
it.
Okay, listen, guys, I want you to put on your headphones, because I want to go back to lockdown for a minute. Michael McNamara, TD, is on the line. Michael, good morning. And sorry for keeping you waiting there. You're quoted in the Business Post today as saying that a return to a lockdown would be an act of tyranny. You're calling it kind of a totalitarian type tactics.
You see, I think that we need to take, everybody needs to take personal responsibility for this, because that's the only way that we can deal with it. But you can't overcome everybody's will with increasingly draconian laws and powers, effectively put people under home arrest, which is what the ultimate lockdown is and was, and at the same time ask people to take personal responsibility for it. Before we ever brought in any legal regulations on the 7th of April, people were responding to the public health advice. We were flattening the curve. And since that, we brought in a series of laws of increasing complexity, some of which bordered on the ridiculous, like defining what a substantial meal was. And people have stopped adhering to the basic public health advice. So either we rely on people to do the right thing for themselves, their neighbours and their families, or we bludgeon them into taking, we completely remove their free will. And we can't sort of remove people's free will while at the same time asking them to take personal responsibility. That's my view.
I suppose, yeah, but like, I think what's happening right now is that we are saying, okay, people cannot be trusted, some people can't, so we need to take away their will.
The whole idea of a lockdown comes from an entirely different society and political system, one where we don't trust people to elect their own government. Our society, our policing force is one of the smallest in the world, our army is even smaller, because we trust people, because we give people the freedom and we expect them to do the right thing. That's not the case in other countries, but it's very much how this country has operated since its inception. We don't have a large Garda force. It's one of the smallest ones in the world per capita, and we've an even smaller army per capita. And people have done the right thing, and people did the right thing at the start of this when they were told this is what you need to do to protect yourself, to protect your neighbours and protect your friends. But then all of that was replaced with laws, and increasingly, as I say, draconian laws, which the approach has failed. There are other countries which have taken a different approach, other countries in Europe, and I think we need to look to countries which are succeeding, like Germany, and like, dare I say it, Sweden at the moment has a lower incidence rate. It's not suffering the same calamitous rise as we appear to be.
Yeah, but I think a lot of countries are now moving to increased restrictions
No country is moving to the level of restrictions that we have at the moment, and we're proposing even greater restrictions. We had far more restrictions in place throughout the summer. We're told now that people are safe to meet outdoors. They can meet outdoors in restaurants and bars, albeit in small numbers. Throughout the summer months, when our incidents were so much lower, people couldn't do that. And then, unsurprisingly, young people met in places where we didn't want them to meet because we gave them nowhere to meet. So, I mean,
Michael, can I interrupt you for a second? There was another interesting point you make, which I think is worth teasing out, which is, I suppose, a lot of people are questioning whether people would actually wear another lockdown, right? You reckon that people will snap?
I do. I mean, I think the response would be different in different parts of the country, but I certainly, from talking to people across Clare as recently as yesterday, I don't think that people have it in them to adhere to another lockdown. People do want to be careful, people do want to be responsible, but people don't want to have every facet of their life governed by the government. And I think it would be a mistake.
You think also think at this stage that the medics have replaced the bishops as the kind of the moral guardians of our society, I suppose. And you say that anyone who disagrees with them now is painted as a dangerous heretic. Is that really how you feel?
It is. I mean, for a long time during the summer, if you questioned Neffet, if you questioned the orthodoxy of a lockdown is the only way to go and increasing restrictions the only way to go, you were painted as some kind of a right-wing conspiracy theorist. I do question Neffet. I think they've done a lot of good. I think they're certainly well-intentioned. But if you look at some of the figures, I mean, for example, that Sunday night when they met advocating an immediate move to stage five, they based it on an increase in deaths. Yet when questioned on that, they accepted that the increase in deaths was an increase in historical deaths, which had been notified, deaths from weeks and months previously, which were notified, rather than an increase in actual deaths.
I don't know of that, but I'll take your word for it for now.
Neffet accepted that. But okay. Look, a spokesman for Neffet accepted that. But I do believe that Neffet is giving advice to government based solely on how to contain COVID-19, but our health system is broader than how to contain COVID-19. It doesn't even look at the effects it's having on mental health.
What should we do now, Michael?
I think we need to go back to explaining to people. I've met nobody anywhere in Ireland who wants to get COVID-19 or bring it home to their families. So we need to explain to people what are the risks in engaging in various types of activity and give people a sense of freedom to do the right thing. Because if you remove that freedom to do the right thing, I think people will rebel against that and are rebelling against that.
Okay, Michael. Gabrielle Colleran wants to make a point to you.
So I just have to come in on that point of saying that Neffet aren't taking in things other than COVID-19. That's just a fallacy. It's being repeated. It's not true. The public health physicians who are sitting on Neffet, they're the people who are actually trained to take in the social determinants of health, the impact of homelessness, the impact of losing jobs, the impact on mental health, the impact on access to healthcare. They're specifically trained for that. So they are taking it in account. And you know, there was a lot of talk there about personal responsibility, but there needs to be much more talk about employers' responsibility. I'm hearing from multiple friends in the private sector who are under pressure to go to their places of work, who were working remotely during lockdown and working effectively remotely. And so we need to be saying to employers to stop putting pressure on people to come into work physically where they can safely work from home. I can't work from home. I have to go into the hospital to do my job. But I can tell from the traffic when I'm cycling in and out the N11 that the traffic is now back to what it was pre-March, which is telling me that employers are not supporting and enabling workers to work from home where they can, and that people are under undue pressure to come into work. Everything we're doing is about trying to reduce the opportunities to the virus to spread. So contexts that we can cut that don't impact on people's lives as much. So working from home, that then means people can have some of the other things.
Point taken. Yeah, Michael. I'd
agree very much with your second point regarding employment. And again, that goes down to giving people freedom to make the right decisions. And employers have to do that too. But on your first point, I don't accept it. We have stopped measuring suicide and self-harm in this country. How on earth can you take account of it if we've even stopped measuring?
Okay, Michael, will
prove
you
prove that point? Where is your evidence for that? You're just making a random statement.
I'm not. The self-harm registry, it has been covered at length in the media. We have stopped measuring self-harm in Ireland. We stopped collating that data at the time of the first lockdown.
Okay. Well, look, we'll check that.
Reasonably reputable.
Okay,
reasonably reputable outfit.
Okay, we'll check that now. Michael, will you stay on the line? And Professor Anthony Staines is on the other line as well. Anthony Staines, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan. How are you?
Grand. What do you make of what Michael is saying first?
I think the evidence from the opinion polls that the Department of Health has been doing for the last, I believe, 4 months is that there's quite significant public support for more restrictions. First of all, I think the population get it. One of my colleagues from Australia has just tweeted a few hours ago, numbers in Victoria, one case today, two from yesterday, 500 to 800 per day a couple of months ago. Australia has been very brave in terms of biting the bullet to nail this virus. A small few countries leading, while most of the world dithers, clinging to the recurring lockdown strategy.
So Anthony,
exit strategy from lockdowns. The Conservative Party in England, not exactly the core of intellectual power in the world, made the same call this morning. They're looking for a way out of what we're doing at the moment.
So you think, obviously, that zero COVID is now an idea whose time has come as we see what the alternative is more and more, yes?
I think the economic evidence is becoming clearer and clearer. There are two large economic studies, both of which show that the major driver of economic harm is viral circulation, not state response. And this was done; these were done in South Korea and the United States. The IMF report on the state of the world economy, which came out this week, has a whole chapter about COVID. And their conclusion is that the virus causes huge economic damage. Lockdowns cause huge economic damage. And there is no way back to restoring the economy without stopping the virus circulating.
Anthony, will you hold that thought? And before I ask you how zero COVID might work at this point, I think Dan O'Brien would like to come in there. He's looking exasperated.
Look, the argument, I've heard a lot of medics say that the economic evidence is very clear. Now, with the greatest respect, economists don't know whether the economic evidence is very clear. And Anthony, that report from the IMF that you just cited was a very elegantly hedged analysis that did not come down either way. The big question is, to what extent has economic activity been stifled by people's fear of the disease and therefore, you know, the prevalence of the disease, and how much by measures taken by government? We just don't know. It's one of those things that we still don't know yet. You know, New Zealand, its economy contracted by as much as Belgium's and Italy's, two of the worst affected countries, in the second quarter of the year. So the jury is out. So please, Anthony, don't say it's clear. It's not clear.
China is the only large country whose GDP has risen.
China's an authoritarian country. I think we need to be very clear about taking any data out of China, okay?
The evidence, such as it is, and when you look across the OECD, leaving China to one side, and look at the rate of viral circulation and look at the fall in GDP, there's a very strong correlation between the two. Now, I am not...
There's not a strong correlation. There's some correlation, Anthony. We've got one quarter of data. It is much too early. Please don't say something is certain when it's not certain.
We have estimates for the year.
They are just forecasts. They are forecasts.
Supports the case that the virus is doing a great deal of damage.
Of course,
that's
true.
And there is evidence from other major disease outbreaks, that viral circulation causes severe economic injury. There's evidence from studies in West Africa. The economy was not the focus of those studies. It's an incidental. There's evidence from studies of the flu pandemic in 1918.
There's lots of evidence, Anthony, but it's not definitive. Okay, so please, I just appeal to you. Don't say that we have definitive knowledge about the economics of this, because we don't.
With great respect, Dan, you've been saying that we do, and that the only problem is the lockdown.
I have been at pains throughout all of this to say exactly what Gabrielle said at the beginning, that it will take years before we know who got this right and who got it wrong. There are massive uncertainties.
And in the meantime, we have to make decisions now.
Okay, and Anthony, just briefly, how would zero COVID work for us now? I see you're saying in The Sun today we'd need to cancel Christmas. So how long are we looking at locking down for to get to zero COVID?
Whatever happens, the strategy is going to be bringing the number of cases of virus down. Because, again, despite Dan's comments, I can assure you the Irish Health Service is unable to cope with what is happening now and will be unable to cope.
That's going to take
a minimum of 8 to 10 weeks.
In a fairly comprehensive lockdown, yes?
I'm just being honest.
Do you honestly think people could wear it again at this stage? Like, do you think they'll go with it?
I think they will. I think with a clear direction, people will go with it. People won't go with it if there's no indication as to why we're doing it. But if there's a clear political leadership that says, this is what we're doing, we're doing it to reduce misery, reduce deaths, stop the health service falling flat on its face, begin to restore the economy, that all makes sense. And whatever strategy we follow after that, strong suppression is arguably necessary.
But do we not get to... Michael, go on.
Yeah, I mean, it's the strategy that comes after I'm interested in. I mean, there are medics
who say that elimination is not possible. There are medics who say it is possible. I'm not qualified to adjudicate on that. But either way, what comes after, if you do seek to have an elimination policy like Australia, like New Zealand, which are isolated islands, very far away from other countries with which they have open borders. We have an open border with Northern Ireland. You cannot pursue an elimination strategy and you cannot maintain one without sealing the border and having quarantining at that border. Whether that border is the border that we have with Northern Ireland or whether that border is, as advocated by the Zero COVID Ireland people, between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. But we have to recognise Arlene Foster has ruled out travel restrictions between Northern Ireland and the rest of the United Kingdom. The Dublin government and indeed Michelle O'Neill of the Northern Irish Executive has ruled out closing the border between North and South. So a zero COVID Ireland or a zero COVID island strategy is a fantasy without a border. Where to put the border on this island has eluded this state for 100 years.
This is simply untrue.
I didn't interrupt you once, Anthony. It is absolutely, I mean, Tomás Ryan was one of the advocates of it. How do you stop it coming in without a border?
Okay, Michael, got your point. Anthony, I'll give you one brief last reply there.
We do it like we do any other public health problem. We deal with individual cases as they arise. We get the numbers down to a level at which public health can cope. There's a huge incentive in the north, whose economy is busily collapsing too, as the virus rises. There's a huge incentive in the north to get this right. North and south, we work together. Cases will come into the island. You're absolutely right. But we manage those cases as they come, as they've done in New Zealand, as they're doing
in They're quarantining in New Zealand. For God's sake, please, they're quarantining in New Zealand. They're quarantining Australia, and they intend to do so indefinitely into the future. We cannot do that because we're in the European Union, which is a social, political, and economic union. We're also
Michael McNamara. Okay, we got your point. Thank you very much, Michael McNamara, and thank you very much, Professor Anthony Staines. And that one, I have no doubt, is going to run and run. Stephanie Preisner, in terms of the younger people, the front of the Observer today talks about Generation COVID and a generation.
Is that what we're calling them? We used to be millennials.
There you go. Or like possibly the millennials and younger. The what's coming after them? Generation Y. Z, I beg your pardon. Do you people feel like you're being uniquely messed around in this, in terms of from everything from employment to mental health to the lack of socialising, everything? Are you starting to feel hard done by?
The only time I feel hard done by is when I hear you talking about how hard done by we are. But no, seriously, we definitely are, because we're coming out of it, like we were stung by the gig economy, which has now kind of collapsed, and we're trying to find our feet. But I don't think about myself as part of a generation. It, like the way that people suggest that sometimes millennials consider ourselves, it's just us against the rest of the world. But like
your peers and the people you know?
My peers.
How are they getting on with this?
They're getting on. Well, there's a cohort of them who are terrified, who are very quickly scrambling to retrain, to try and get jobs that might be more secure. A couple of my friends are considering doing the GAMSATs, going back, trying to be doctors, something in the health service. Then there are another cohort who are working from home. And there's an interesting piece in the Business Post today on page 6 about what remote working could mean for the end of high-rise buildings in Dublin, but what remote working could mean for the end of people being able to socialise. I have a lot of friends who are kind of around my age, you know, in their early 30s, late 20s, who are single, who are working from home for the conglomerates like Facebook, who are Twitter, Google, on their own all day long. They're not working from home. They're living at work. They can't, like, it's not ending. The work, the emails are coming in because they're working, some of their team are in San Francisco. The emails are coming in 24/7. They have no real reason not to reply to the emails because they're not doing anything else. They're finished Netflix. They can't have anyone over to their house. They can't go to anyone else's house. There's nothing else to do. And for the ones who are single, it's really, really lonely. And they're, the fear, like, some of them know that they're not going back to the office until at least June 2021. And that protracted road ahead of them is very, very terrifying. And I think the idea that now people are like, oh, hey, it's cool, we're all going to work from home now and we're never going to go back to the office, and Dublin will have no high-rise buildings and, you know, like all these office blocks are going to be resold and they're going to be apartments, is really scary for people.
Yeah, I see there's a lovely new phrase for it now, distributed working, they're calling it, which...
Oh, there'll be loads of...
much nicer than it is. I suppose we should take a break at this stage. So Gabrielle Coller and Stephanie Prizer and Dan O'Brien staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Our panel still with us, Gabrielle Colleran, Stephanie Prizner and Dan O'Brien. Gabrielle, with your hat as Vice President of the IHCA on, what do you make of that story on the front of the Business Post about the private hospital? So, like, we've been waiting and waiting to hear what this deal would be. We understood that it was kind of close to being done, and now we hear that this surge capacity that we wanted from private hospitals may not be there at all.
Well, I guess the first thing to sort of say is, you know, people understand you making a mistake, but they don't accept you not learning. So I think if we look back at the first deal and the things that went on with that, there's a huge amount of learning from everyone about how not to do it in terms of a top-down approach that didn't have collaboration, where the consultants who were delivering the care were excluded from it, and there was huge issues around continuity of care for their patients. So this time now is an opportunity for a much more agile, integrated, collaborative approach, which seems to be the goal of this, that it is actually interacting with the individual private hospitals. And from my perspective, it's most likely to be successful and impactful for patients when it is the local public hospitals engaging with the local private hospitals, maximising on the strengths and the collaborations that are there, and then delivering for patients. But obviously, it's still ongoing. It hasn't been resolved yet. And we are at a point where we are coming to where the health service is approaching trickier waters. I mean, Philip Nolan's estimates about where we could be at the end of October, unless things change, are concerning. So I'd just be hopeful that people will have learned from the lessons of the last time and that we'll see some resolution, because...
I read in the... There's another piece in the Business Post with one of your colleagues, and sorry, his name escapes me now, but did I read in that we didn't ever surge into the private hospitals the last time?
So the surge capacity in terms of COVID care and ICU care wasn't needed, but what was done was say, I'd give the example of Vincent Young and his team in James's. They did some of their complex surgeries in the Black Rock, and that worked very effectively for lung cancer, so there were no delay in lung cancer surgeries.
That only happened very late in the deal, am I right? That wasn't happening originally, was it?
Well, I think that was one of the more effective examples, as was the collaboration between Cork and the Bonds, and that came down to there being really good local relationships. So again, it comes back to learning from the mistakes of the last time so that this time is more effective.
So is this time what they would have in mind is that 40% of capacity that they're looking to take, that it would be for keeping non-COVID care going. Is that right?
Well, I think they've said...
Do we need the ICU beds in the private hospitals?
I think they've said both, because the issue is that if our ICUs in the public hospitals are filled with patients with COVID-19,
But they never were it the last time. No.
Well, the last time we came up to over 550 theoretical beds, and again, Coleman sort of goes into it in the articles that in some cases they had beds with ventilators, but they didn't have the nurses and doctors to run it. So if you don't have the nurses and doctors to run it, it's not a real bed. But Brendan, if we just step back for a second, a long time ahead of COVID, back in 2009, the HSE's prospectus report said we needed to increase our ICU to 589.
I think we're all familiar with all of that, but I think people are slightly confused about this. So we didn't need the extra ICU beds in the private hospitals at any point in the last time. No?
Not for COVID-19 patients, but we did need them for some of the complex oncology patients who had their surgeries done in the private hospitals who used them. So that was really effective. So those lung cancer patients would be an example of it, where the James's lung cancer patients had their surgeries done in the Black Rock, and that was really effective.
Yeah, and of course that is just as critical
absolutely,
care.
Absolutely. And again, if we're talking about whole population health and looking at it from the point of view of wanting morbidity and mortality for everything to at least be at the rates they were last year, then that's the sort of the holistic approach. But I think
one more question, and Dan wants to come in then. Is it very difficult to turn around to for a private hospital to be told in 5 days' time we need X amount of your capacity, or we need X number of beds, or we need X size? Is it hard to run a private hospital with 5 days' notice that somebody might want to come in and take up a chunk of your hospital?
Well, I think that'd be challenging for any hospital because in terms of scheduled care, you're booking people in the context of COVID-19. People are having their tests and they're cocooning 2 weeks ahead of having surgeries. So that would be very challenging. But again, Brendan, if we step back and take the macro approach to it, there's about 2,000 beds in the private hospitals. There's about 12,000 beds in the public system. You know, the National Development Plan said we were going to put in 2,600 beds into the public system. What we need to do is front load those beds, put in the modular capacity, put in the staff to run those beds and get our public hospital capacity up. Like our colleagues in the private sector, they will do all they can, but they will also be trying to ensure they can look after the patients they already have a duty of care for. But the answer is actually in sustainable permanent capacity in the healthcare system.
Of course.
And we have to deliver that a lot quicker. Like 8 years to deliver a public bed, that's just not good enough. When we decide we're going to build a bed, we just have to do it.
Okay, and we are told there are more beds coming. Dan, you want to come in on that?
Again, just as a non-adversarial discussion, Gabrielle, you know, you mentioned that what happened in Lombardy, and that sent the fear of God through everyone in the medical community across the world, that we would be inundated as they were in Lombardy. Now, you know, as you say, that didn't happen the last time around. And in the short term, I totally take all your points about the longer term thing. But I think the decision to start shutting down, making hundreds of thousands of people unemployed, we have to... It looks at the risk of Ireland having a Lombardy type situation. How great do you think that risk is, given what's happening now around the rest of Europe?
So the honest answer is that I don't know, and I'm not qualified to make that presumption. But what I do know is that most of our ICU capacity as it stands is taken up with non-COVID care. So we don't have the surge capacity to deal with a second surge of COVID-19. And if we do like we did the last time, where we have to hobble together additional ICU beds by redirecting nurses and doctors from other services, that does involve what happened the last time, which was shutting down some of those services with the impact on cancer service and all the other non-COVID
but
care.
Can we at least put the question that would be a better option than putting hundreds of thousands of people into unemployment and shutting down thousands of business? At least it's something that has to be weighed up.
Well, I would say the answer actually is in putting the capacity into the public hospitals so that we can provide the care for everyone without shutting down the economy. Because again, Dan, I'm very conscious everything I want to do for patients in the health service requires tax to be coming in to fund that. So it's not a question of the economy or the health service. Actually, the two are twinned. And if you give us the capacity, we can look after everyone. And then you guys who have the expertise on the economy, you can take care of that. That's not my area, but delivering care and capacity is. And what's clear is we have decades of undercapacity in our public health system, of doctors, of nurses, of health professionals calling on the government to address it, and now finally we have to.
Okay, listen, speaking of the economy, lest we forget, we had a budget just a matter of days ago. I know we all move on very quickly now, bouncing from catastrophe to catastrophe, as Dan would have it. Stephanie Prison, what was your take on the budget?
It's gas, so we haven't, like, we're nearly an hour into it, we haven't mentioned the budget. It's like when they talk, you know, what they say, like, at a music festival, no one mentions the toilets if they were good. Like, there's no, like, it was, I think across the board, across this whole pandemic, the government have really stepped in. And I don't know, is it fair to say that as the level of restrictions that we're talking about maybe happening increase, that the government are kind of putting some serious muscle into supporting those businesses that are going to have to close? And I think what we saw from the budget was a real genuine, it seemed really genuine. Now, I don't know if it's because Pascal Dunne, who is just seems like a really genuine man, he was delivering the speech, but it seemed like they really are trying to support businesses and individuals and the economy. And obviously they can't support everyone at all times, but it seemed like there wasn't really anyone who got totally left behind in this budget. And it kind of made me feel like, okay, it's going to be grand. Like, at least there's money there and things are going to be okay. Now, I'm not an economist.
So you felt safe?
I felt safe, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Dan, of course, there are big questions there. One of them, Kevin Cunningham in the Sunday Indo, is among a good few people writing about this kind of idea. I suppose that is neoliberalism being rolled back, and we have a great nostalgia now for the Keynesian kind of decades when we built the world as we know it and all that.
Yeah, well, even before COVID, there was definitely, you know, the ideas move back and forth, and there's a faddishness in terms of that balancing between the state and markets. And after the Second World War and the Great Depression, we became
in the Western world more status, so the governments did more and they put in place more public services. And then in the 80s, after the crisis of the 1970s, it went back the other way and it was more, let's have more competition, let's have the market do more. And, you know, since the financial crisis, it's gone back the other way. And I think it's been moving in that way. There's a greater willingness to have a bigger state, have higher, the part about higher taxes, I think, is that'll come down the line. If we want to have a bigger state, we will have to pay more taxes.
And specifically, I think a lot of people saying that the rich and corporations will need to pay more taxes if we're going to have a bigger government, yes?
Well, people say that. Just to highlight, one of the reasons our tax revenues have held up well here is because we've an extremely... our tax system really taxes the wealthy much more. We tax lower paid people very little relative to other countries. And because it's overwhelming, this crisis has put on lower paid people out of work overwhelmingly. Because they weren't paying that much tax, it means it hasn't affected the government's finances that much. Now, the question really is that if you are going to raise taxes on higher incomes are already high by European standards, lower incomes, they're not. So the question then becomes, are you going to really ramp up taxes on higher earning people, or are you going to bring taxes on lower earning people to more normal levels? Companies,
I think people would say beyond income tax, that the very wealthy who don't tend to pay a lot of tax and who don't necessarily make their earnings through the PAYE system, is that where we need to be looking?
Well,
and corporations.
It's always, you know, do we increase corporation tax? The risk of that is that we have fewer companies coming here creating jobs. You tax the wealthy very much, they go off to tax havens in the Caribbean and move all their money offshore. You know, that's...
So we're left with a question here then. And again, several people mentioning this. I think Pat Rabbit mentions it in the Business Post and Hugh O'Connor mentions it. There seems to be this fear in the government that it's going to be very difficult to roll back on some of all this increased spending.
Absolutely. What was the way? You know, there's a ratchet effect. Once you commit money, you know, people fight tooth and nail to keep it. So, you know, this could well be very, very difficult to roll back. Because that's the nature of state intervention. Once it starts, it's difficult to pull back from.
So I'll come to you in 1 second, Gabriel. Are we into, Dan, in your opinion as an economist, are we into an era of just bigger government now, and it's going to have to be paid for some way or another?
Certainly bigger. How much bigger? That's the question. And, you know, we have to see what happens. You know, if the COVID crisis ends up, you know, in a global depression and a collapse, you know, we could be in having not very much government at all.
Okay, Gabrielle.
I guess I'd agree with the points that Dan has made there, but I would add to it, you know, we're talking about people on lower incomes paying lower tax, but we have a very serious situation with regards to housing and the cost of housing in this country. And I don't think it's appropriate that it's aspirational for two nurses to be able to buy a 3-bedroom semi-detached house in Dublin where they work, if they work in Dublin. But that's the way it is now with the price of housing. And, you know, there were a lot of good things from a health perspective in the budget in terms of the winter plan, investment in the trauma strategy, oncology, maternity strategy. Those are really good things that will improve care. But like, if we look at the housing aspect of it, like $1 billion going to private landlords and only $100 million into affordable housing. Like if we go back to social determinants of health, like access to housing.
Well, it does seem we're going to get the guts of 10,000 social houses built next year and for the next 5 years, which was essentially what all the various parties had promised variations on that in their back in another world before the election.
So. Yeah, I guess I just think that in the context of trying to reduce social inequality, because again, if we look at this pandemic and we were talking about people, you know, some people not keeping to the regulations, one of the things that we haven't mentioned is that it is easier for some of us than others to keep to them. Like I have, you know, a nice size house, a lovely back garden. I can cycle to work or I can drive to work. It's a lot easier for me, aside from the fact that I work in a hospital, to avoid getting COVID-19 where I live, where I work.
I was talking to a doctor the other day who said to me, like, you could draw the map of Dublin based on the COVID map.
Yeah.
And it's based on socioeconomic factors.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing that I would sort of mention, and again, not to be negative, but just to point it out, was that you know, childcare has been a huge issue throughout this pandemic. And, you know, in healthcare, 79% of the workforce are female and women disproportionately are impacted by childcare. And like we had a situation where, you know, Regina Doherty said that like healthcare workers needed to improvise during lockdown. And now as we're going into the second surge in the winter, we still don't have like additional services around what will happen for healthcare workers, you know, if the schools close again or if childcare closes again. And, you know, the amount given to that in the budget didn't change. And there's two things, you know, the state are very uninvolved in terms of investment in childcare compared to other European countries. And wages in the childcare sector are also paradoxically low. And I would make the point with my feminist hat on that if we look at leadership in this pandemic in this country, it is predominantly men in all those positions. Like there was an article yesterday about the people meeting to discuss NPHET. Great people, all of them very well qualified. 9 or 10 of them, not a single woman in it. And I would make the point that representation matters. When women are not at the table, issues that disproportionately represent women don't get adequate consideration and don't get appropriate solutions. And we are seeing this in the pandemic. And when we're writing the post hoc and the post match analysis, the fact that women have been disadvantaged by this and many of us have been impacted by the lack of availability of childcare and the lack of state supports for childcare and solutions around that.
Stephanie, would you agree with that, that it's a lot of men?
Yeah. And I don't think it's done out of any malice, but if 10 men are sitting around a table, they've never had to consider childcare before, why would they start considering it now? Do you know? It just doesn't come into their minds. And that's, they have other things to think about, fair enough.
Not maybe that childcare is not men's equal responsibility as well. Let's be
it is, it should be. But Brendan, like, let's face it, it's not. Like, it, that's just not what we're seeing across the board. During the pandemic, we were seeing disproportionately women. Yeah, some men stepped up, but it turned out to be women's job. And now it's women's job. It hasn't come up in the budget. I would like to ask, you know, what would you have taken out to put in childcare? I understand that they can't do everything. Childcare would have been great. They've said this is a government of 5 budgets. Maybe it'll come up the next time if we continue the public pressure for it. But not just childcare. It's sort of shocking, okay, the lack of women's representation when in these places that make decisions. You don't agree with me, Dan?
Well, Dan doesn't have time to disagree with you. And Dan, you know what? Let discretion be the better part of valour on this occasion. Funny though, 18 billion and it still wasn't enough, was it? All right, listen, thanks a million, guys. Thanks, Gabrielle Colleran. Thanks, Stephanie Preisner. And thanks, Dan O'Brien.